You're tuned to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, Community Radio for East Central Illinois.
Good morning, good morning. You have entered Higher Ground with Sister Carol and Stevie Wonder. Higher Ground is our theme song from Stevie Wonder. And I just really like that song. I think it prepares me for the radio show and what we're going to do this morning. So I hope you're out either watching a marathon or running in it, one or two. And if you're running, I guess you're not listening. But those who are just getting up this morning on this kind of brisk, rainy, cold rain Saturday morning. But we're still thankful to be able to feel the rain and enjoy it. This morning, we're going to have a guest call in. The first hour is certainly going to update you on what's happening at the Capitol. What's happening? What's happening at the Capitol? That's what we're going to talk about this morning. I want to update you on the higher ed appropriation bill that the stopgap measure that was done last week. I'll have on the air this morning calling in our House chair, Democratic chair, Ms. Rita Mayfield. She's Representative Rita Mayfield, all the way at the top of the state of Illinois near the Waukegan area. She's going to call in and talk about the bill, why she moved the bill, and really what it means. I know there's a lot of media going on around what we're certainly clear about as a stopgap measure to save, at that time, four of our public universities in the state of Illinois. So that measure, we'll talk about that. She should be calling in with me here about 8:10 this morning. I just want to let you know that the views and opinions here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associates, station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated. These views belong to me and ultimately to the guests and perhaps to you if you decide to call in. I want to just start off by giving you the call-in number. And I think somebody's calling in already. Wow, we just got started. Go ahead, caller, you're on the air. Perhaps you are. Are you there?
Yes.
Oh, good morning. How are you?
I am good.
Very good, Ms. Rita Mayfield. I was just introducing you before I realized that you were calling.
Oh, well, see, that worked out really well.
Perfect timing. You was filling me on this one. I was just telling our listeners here at WEFT, this radio station is services all of Champaign-Urbana, a little bit going east as well as west going back toward Springfield. And so large area of folks that listen to WEFT 90.1 FM. And people can listen live at WEFT.org. And we also have a live call-in show. So I will give the live call-in number for those who are up early this morning listening. You want to call in, you can call at 217-359-6545. If you want to ask myself or Representative Rita Mayfield a question on this topic or any topic in relationship to state government this morning, feel free to give us a call at 217-359-6545. So with that, and I've done all of my responsibilities here, I want to welcome you to WEFT, Representative Rita Mayfield.
Awesome. Thanks for having me on this morning.
I kind of talked to just briefly about your district. Can you give us a clearer picture of where your district is and its makeup?
I serve in the far northeast region of the state. My district is Waukegan, North Chicago, with parts of Beach Park, Gurnee, and Wadsworth.
Oh, Gurnee. So that means you can get me free tickets or something to Six Flags.
No, my district stops right at the amusement park. That's how I'm like, wait a minute, you couldn't draw the line just a little further to the west?
Darn.
I know, that's how I felt, too.
I thought I was going to get some tickets to Six Flags. You know that stuff is expensive, so I don't go anymore.
Oh, gosh, tell me about it. My daughter has a season pass, so yes.
Oh, look at you. So let's talk a little bit about last week when we were in session. All the way down to the final, the 11th hour, we had to pass a bill, higher education stopgap funding bill. How did you end up getting that bill? Why did you take that bill? I understand that none of the schools are in your district. So how did you end up getting that bill, Rita?
Well, just, you know, it was actually an initiative of the Legislative Black Caucus. We were having meetings, and the subject just kept coming up over and over and over again. What are we going to do about our universities and our colleges? We have to provide some type of funding. And then in the midst of that, we had a couple colleges that were looking to either do massive layoffs or close their doors. So the first thing that we did is we came up with our own bill. It was House Bill 5045. What that bill did, it provided emergency funding at 100%. For four universities and then partial funding for a fifth university. So it was Chicago State, Northeastern Illinois, Eastern Illinois, and Western Illinois. They would all be funded at 100%. And then we had $100,000. No, was it 100 or 10? I'm sorry, $10,000 was in there for SIU. So that was the initial bill. And basically, you know, when I filed the bill, I was being told by everybody, well, you can file the bill. It's not going to go anywhere. I'm like, no, we're going to pass this bill because we cannot allow these schools to close. So I went across the aisle, talked to some of my Republican colleagues and said, you know what, I've got this bill. I added your district because I understand your districts are in just as dire straits as these other districts here. And they signed on to the bill. And everything went from like wildfire from there because now we actually had a bill where we had both Democrat and Republicans on, and individuals started to pay attention. Like, well, wait a minute. If you're going to do a bill that's going to have bipartisan support, can we add these other universities and colleges? Can we do that? So then it became a very collective process where, you know, we tried to be as inclusive as possible. You know, we had, like I said, Democrats and Republicans, but we also had individuals that represented, like, downstate Illinois as well, because their needs were a little bit different. So we just wanted to make sure everybody was in there. We had representatives from IMSA. That's our school for the gifted, which are funded. They're the only school that is funded through higher ed. Our community colleges, you know, then we needed somebody who was in there. Hey, well, what about MAP grants? We have to fund MAP grants. And the final bill that we came up with was an agreed bill by basically everybody that was in the room, and it was just a wonderful experience. You had all of this energy flowing, everybody wanting to do something positive within the means that we had. It's a very fiscally responsible bill that we ended up passing, and I think we did a great job. I really do.
So let me go, I'm going to step back a little bit because I'm in the conversation and part of it, so it makes it easier for me to be able to step back a little bit. So you started off with a bill because the dire situation with Chicago State, Eastern Illinois, Western, and was it Northern Illinois?
Yes.
University? Okay, so those...
No, Northeastern.
Northeastern. So those schools initially were either on the brink of closing, which would have been... Friday, actually, today is the 30th of April, which was the drop dead for Chicago State, right?
Right. Chicago State was looking to close this month. Western said if they didn't get some type of money, that they would be downsizing starting next month. They were looking to start the process of closing their doors. Doesn't mean they're going to close next month, but they were definitely going to start that process.
Okay.
Eastern was in a similar situation as well as Northeastern. And then, as I mentioned, with... SIU, there were some needs that were there as well. So we were trying to just help everybody, you know, and we had found money, believe it or not. I know everybody says there's no money, but we had actually found
So tell me where did you find this money at?
Okay, well, the tale of two bills. Both bills had a different funding stream. The initial funding stream was based upon the borrowing that we had did last year. The governor had asked to sweep some funds so that we could pay our backlog of bills and just basically put us in a good position. We agreed to that as a General Assembly. We swept the bills, we swept the funds, and we paid a lot of bills. Well, now it's time to pay those bills back. So the governor was asking if we could do a forgiveness, not so much pay those bills back, but use that funding for something else. So we were saying, okay, yes, we'll give you the forgiveness as long as the money, you know, was just not used randomly, but it was used for a very specific purpose, which would be to fund our university. So that's where the first funding stream came from.
Okay.
The second funding stream actually came from the Education Assistance Fund, because now we're looking at funding pretty much everybody, and we needed a lot more money than we had available through the sweep. So we actually found two designated streams where there was availability for us to actually fund some.
Okay.
And I think that's important because we weren't using fantasy dollars. We were using real dollars.
Yes, because we kept hearing the conversation about, well, you guys keep passing these bills that have no funding source. There's no funding. There's no money. But the money that was ultimately found, the $600 million that was found to fund the stopgap measure, and I do want to use the word stopgap because I want us to talk about that a little bit since the media
–
And some of our colleagues have changed the conversation, but that money was sitting in the education fund, correct?
Yes. That's absolutely correct.
So Governor Bruce Rauner signed into legislation, what, 2 Mondays ago? Or was it last Monday?
Just this last Monday.
Just past Monday, right? So this past Monday, he signs into law the legislation that we passed last Friday.
Right.
And ultimately is appropriating this money to the schools so that the schools don't close. But in the meantime, now the conversation has shifted where not only school leadership and administration are saying that this bill was in essence a cut of 70% to their budgets. What do you say to that?
Well, you know what? I say that was never the conversation. You know, from the very onset, what we were asking for was stopgap funding. That meant that this was not the end-all be-all. This was not FY16. I believe I even stated that on the record more than once, you know, because I didn't want that confusion. This is not an FY16 budget bill. This right here was simply what it said it was, which was stopgap funding, meaning intermediate funding until we can get that FY16 budget. Now, if individuals decide that they don't want to work on that budget, well, then shame on them, because we still owe money and a great deal of money to these universities and colleges. We owe the rest of the MAP grant money that was promised to our students. We, have, as a General Assembly, need to keep our word, and we need to keep moving forward. We need to keep working together, not trying to undermine each other, because I did hear those conversations as well, and I was like, well, wait a minute. We had this conversation when we first introduced the bill, you know, when we were talking in a bipartisan room, and everybody agreed that this was going to be stopgap, not a cut to higher ed, which nobody would have signed on to. It was just supposed to be a temporary measure to provide temporary relief until we can get that budget. And I, for one, am ready to still work on that budget.
So the colleges and universities right now, who in essence have been temporarily saved, this measure will keep their operations going until about September, right?
That's correct. But hopefully we will have a budget before then. You know, I think we've got an issue in the General Assembly, because there are some people that, for whatever reason, they can say they want a budget, but when it comes time to working on a budget, they don't want to work on a budget. They just want speaking points. They want to go on the radio and point fingers and do this and that. But the issue is, we have an opportunity here to really sit down, put together an FY16 and an FY17 budget. But it takes a collective group of individuals to want to do that.
So the interesting thing about this is, again, I'll continue to use the word stopgap measure, because there is an attempt to rewrite what actually happened. And I recall witnessing, as you presented the bill on the floor, continuing to use the word stopgap measure. This is not the final version of our higher ed budget for 2016. And certainly as we approach 2017, have you heard, I'm not up in the Chicagoland area, so I miss a lot of that, but have you heard any conversation about, oh, well, let's scrap 16 and just start working on 17, or is there a combination conversation going on?
Well, I haven't heard, but I've been reading just a lot of the different editorials and the comments. I'm sure you're aware, right after, within minutes, 5 minutes of passing the bill, Leader Durkin jumped out there and said he didn't make a commitment for FY16 for anything other than human services, and that was not the agreement. The governor did correct him and say we would still continue to work on FY16. So we really, you know, so there seems to be a disconnect in their party somewhere, and they need to make sure that we're all on the same page, because our understanding is that we're going to continue working on FY16. If you look at the amount of money that was given to your university, so I understand you have University of Illinois.
Yes.
That small amount of money is not enough to sustain the University of Illinois
and its
programs.
Yeah.
I had a very good opportunity to meet with a couple of your scientists, and we have to keep those programs going. I mean, you're doing wonderful things down there, you know, and to say that, you know, we're not going to give you the money when we have the means of giving you the money is just flat out wrong. And, you know, that's why I keep telling, you know, the constituents, don't celebrate, keep the pressure on. Hey, yes, thank you. You know, you gave us a small amount of money to keep our doors open and our lights on, but we need the rest of our money. We have other programs that are dependent on this money.
That's correct.
It is your responsibility as a General Assembly to pass a budget.
So let me hold you for a second. I have a caller that called in. Hello, caller, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
What can we do for you this morning? I have Representative Rita Mayfield here.
I'm an alumni from the university, and I just don't see why you're celebrating a 30% or 70% cut to get 30% of what you're asking for.
Well,
hello, sir.
You
didn't hear my last comment, because that's exactly what I said. We are not celebrating 30%. We need to make sure that the university gets all 100% of the money that it is owed. And it is not a case that we don't have the money to give. It's a case that we don't have a budget in place. And we need individuals to make sure that they are still putting pressure on their legislators, that they're still putting pressure on the governor's office to pass that FY16. You need the rest of your money. That was my statement, and that's exactly where we are. We need to make sure we are still putting that pressure there. The fact that we're keeping the lights on and the doors open does not fund your program.
That's
well,
our goal.
One of the things that I still think there's a problem for us is that now there's no pressure on you guys to do anything.
Well, I disagree. I disagree. Just like there was pressure to do this, that pressure has to remain. See, that's the problem. A lot of times when you give individuals money, and we're running, and this is why we're a little hesitant for human services, is because if you give people money, the pressure stops. We do not want the pressure stopped. We want it to continue. Those phone calls need to continue. Those rallies need to continue. It's not just the legislators' part, it's the constituents as well. You can't just give up because you got a few dollars. You have to keep putting the pressure. If you were sending letters and making phone calls, continue to send those letters and make those phone calls. And we're really reaching out to the university, the college presidents, to the students and saying, hey, don't give up. Make sure you are still making those phone calls, because this is important. You need the rest of your money. Particularly for the University of Illinois, we did not give you enough to fund you for an entire year. Just about half the school would close on that little bit that you were given. That's not acceptable. We cannot have our universities closing. You know, our higher education is a standard for any state. So when you look at a state, you look at what universities do they have? What are they offering their students? What are they offering, you know, to the people that live there? Well, when you start seeing this domino effect of closing universities, you're saying, guess what? We don't have anything to offer, and that's not true. We've got some of the best universities in the United States right here in Illinois. We have people coming from internationally to come to our university. We need to make sure
that's what I'm saying, too, and I think that the black community is also upset, because even the MAP grants, that's only for one semester. Is that right?
It's 42.5%, which should be about a little less than half, so almost two semesters.
Thank you so much for your call, caller.
Well, all right.
Have a great day. I think it's important that people understand that the stopgap measure that was proposed by our leadership and Representative Rita Mayfield, who's with me this morning, and working in concert with our Republican colleagues to try to get this done. The scenario is extremely dire without this concept taking place on last Friday, and ultimately the governor signing it on Monday. It is not a celebration, that's for certain. There is no celebratory effect or feeling. What we see happening across the state is not only is there some kind of backpedaling going on, but colleges and universities are very clear. Those places who have been suffering for months without a state budget, they understand that this is simply a lifeline to keep them going until we can come to terms with the governor and ultimately the legislature coming together to work out a full budget. But I see, Rita, that the governor has said that he's willing to work with the legislature to deal with the budget under certain conditions. Have you heard much about his new conditions to get this done?
No, we have not heard. My understanding is that the turnaround agenda is still is off the table, but it's on the table. He has not said you know, which elements he's really, you know, we actually have to have. But it looks like there seems to be some let up on his end as far as what he's pushing. But we have not seen the final yet. My understanding is that we'll get more information in the coming weeks.
So I want to read a quote from Speaker Madigan that says, quote, while the governor has said he would approve this small portion of funding for higher education, it's unfortunate he was unwilling to approve any further funding for human services. Let's talk a little bit about the human services piece of this and why those two were not put together. Human services, obviously, over the last 10 months, many of them have closed. They've laid off hundreds of staff members. Why was that not a part of this stopgap for human services and higher ed?
The dollar amount for human services is only $400 million. So, and I want people to understand, because I saw the budget that was sent over from the Senate, and unfortunately, what's in that budget is not going to get funded. We owe $390 million for maintenance of effort. That's the money that we actually have to pay as a state in order to get our federal match back. So that means before we can fund anything else, we have to pay maintenance of effort. So that means that only leaves $10 million and nothing gets funded for human services. That's why we didn't include it in the bill, because we want to make sure that the programs are going to be funded and that we're not just playing games with the money. See, there's a miscommunication, and people, you know, you put a bill out there and they'll see their program in there, but what about all the other programs that didn't make it? We're fighting for all the programs. We don't have pet projects that, you know, okay, well, I'm going to put yours in and leave my and leave Carol's out. We're not going to play that game. We're going to fund all of human services. It can be done. You know, now the fact is, rather than trying to do a stopgap, we need a budget. We need a full FY16, FY17 budget. And if your legislators are saying anything different, then you got the wrong legislator, because we need a budget, period. And we need them at the table. This last bill we passed, it took leadership on the part of the representatives. I reached across the aisle. I had representatives over there saying, you know what? I'm going to vote for this bill because I need it for my district. I don't care what leadership says. We had individuals on the Democrat side, same thing. We're going to vote for this bill because we need it. We're not going with, you know, it was not a political bill. It was what was best for the people in the district. That's the only way we're going to get a budget, is if we stop playing politics and we start doing what's right for the people.
So we hope that in the next part of this discussion, right, so we do a stopgap measure that, again, is only a stopgap measure. We have to put the other 70% in some cases on the table for the completion of 16's budget, but
the completion of 16 and the
entering
of 17.
So let's talk about that's a lot of money on the table.
That's a lot of money.
We got to talk about revenue. Where's the revenue?
Well, guess what? We've got revenue. Sometimes we have to do things that we don't want to do, but we've got revenue. You know, there was a bill out there, and I believe it was Representative Franks that introduced it. And I don't have the information in front of me, but it basically looked at closing a lot of corporate loopholes. It looked at the elimination of the lieutenant governor's office. It looked at streamlining some of our departments, things that really need to happen. When you're talking about turning around the state of Illinois, well, guess what? It starts at home. We've got departments that are so top-heavy, it is ridiculous. We haven't made any changes. What we've done is we've continued to hire people. Why are we continually hiring people, you know, at $100,000+ when we don't have a budget? Ask that question. Nobody wants to talk about those things. We are wasting taxpayer dollars.
That's interesting. I need to do a little research on the number of people the governor has hired since he said we don't have any money.
Right. There's a lot. And look at how much they're being paid. Look at how much. I mean, we are giving, you know, it's over $1 billion. It's a lot of money. It's a lot of money. That's money that could have been used for programs.
And so we look at just the different conversations that's going on, or the redirection. The governor visited, I don't know if you know this, but he was here in at the university this past Thursday. And of course, we didn't know he was coming until maybe an hour or two before he was to arrive. But he was greeted by our students at the University of Illinois and not very welcomed. And he was supposed to give a speech, I guess, with the president. And at that moment, the students organized and literally ran the governor off the campus. It was unbelievable. There's video that's been posted of this incident because the students are, as you said, they have to continue to protest, continue to call for the funding that's necessary for the students, the MAP grant. And everybody's not at this point buying the higher education governor talking points.
And no, that's what, absolutely not, because you have to put your money where your mouth is. You know, it's more than just words. It has to be actions. Actions have to follow words. You have to walk the talk.
So I just got a text from someone, and they said, if you were a parent of an incoming freshman, would you trust the MAP grant is going to be covered the second semester, or that the university won't close after the first semester? So we've helped temporarily some of these really dire institutions. As a parent, what would you do in this situation?
I would keep my student in the schools. If the money is promised, we have to deliver it. It's just that simple. And I don't know anyone in the General Assembly that wants to see a school, a university, a college close within their district. It's just not, just like this bill came together, we can put together another bill. And that's what I keep saying. And put the pressure on your representative. Tell them, look, quit playing politics. Do what you just did. Stick together and let's pass a budget. It's that simple. If we pass a budget, everything gets funded.
So our goal in passing this budget has to shift to some revenue conversations. How do you see that coming together as we return? We have about 30 days to work this out, or less than 30 days, 29.
Well, we're not raising taxes. Let's start there. There is no appetite to raise taxes. There is an appetite to fix our current government processes, and then we can look at if we need more additional tax money at that time. But I think the mistake is when you jump out there and say, oh, well, we have to raise taxes to fix the problem. No, we don't. We need to clean our house first, and then we can look at, once we've done all the things that we need to do, you know, asking ourselves, why are we giving tax breaks to corporations that give us nothing back, that have laid off half of their employees, but yet they're getting millions and millions of dollars for a plant that only has 10 employees? Why are we doing that? We're paying them basically $1 million per employee to stay here in Illinois. Is that really worth it? That money could be reinvested. We have other tax breaks that are no longer needed, and we don't understand why. So, and I think we really need to take a look at where our money is going. And again, you know, there is a bill out there that outlines, you know, I'm going to say it's about maybe $2.3 billion in cost savings without raising taxes. I think we need to start there. Do what, you know, some of the things that are in there, even if we can't do them all, let's try to do some of them, maybe even half, you know, to give the taxpayers some relief before we put our hands back in their pocket.
Yeah, I want to give you a quick little interlude here and let the listeners know that you're listening to WEFT 90.1 FM. And on the air with me this morning is Representative Rita Mayfield. She represents the Waukegan area up in Northeast Chicago, and was the sponsor of the stopgap measure higher ed funding bill that passed last Friday, ultimately signed by the governor on this past Monday, to help the struggling colleges and universities in our state just make it through the summer. Our goal was to make it through the summer so we'll have a little more time to come back and continue to work on the budget. She'll take your call if you're interested at 217-359-6545. Go ahead, caller. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hello.
It's Paul. I ought to be working on my show. Hey, you were great on the quad yesterday.
Thank you very much, Paul. I appreciate you calling this morning.
Okay. Well, you know me. I'm about the tax swap, and this, people still don't know what the hell I'm talking about when I talk about it. But Governor Edgar was backing it after he had his Eikenberry Commission. Actually, Don Clark Netsch, people who remember her, I go back a ways, was running on it, and Edgar was campaigning against it. What it is the idea of lowering the property tax and raising the income tax. I know that gets into the school districts, and it gets complicated with all of the money that needs to be shifted around, but it's really a way to, if it's done correctly, like limiting, capping the amount of property tax relief you could get, so that, you know, basic middle class people get all of it, and the people that have two or three mansions or seven, like Rahner, don't get to take all of it.
No, I'm sorry. What's that called again?
It's called a tax swap.
It came up under the Eikenberry Commission. And the idea is to give the property tax relief. Now, the statistics that people cite are that Illinois has the second highest property tax in the country. So it's a place where you could do this balancing thing. And I think we do need a revenue increase. Right now, the personal income tax in Illinois is less than in Hoosierlandia in Indiana. They had to take down all their signs. Rahner hired the guy that had put up the signs in Indiana. So I guess they're going to put up the signs in Illinois now that the income tax is lower in Illinois than Indiana. But, you know, we are not in a high tax state. We're in a highly unfair tax structure state. And one of the ways to remedy that would be to lower the property tax and increase the income tax. And you can just Google tax swap Edgar and you'll find the articles. It's not coming up in the discourse. I had a letter to the editor a while back about it. But I also wanted to go off on Lou Lang, and maybe you're sympathetic. He put up this proposal last week. He introduced a tax structure that's based on the graduated income tax. But what it does is it plays into this whole idea that Illinois is a high tax state, because it gives tax relief to 99% of the population, which is silly. I mean, we are not in a high tax state. The upper income people should pay. We should go back to the level of the surtax, but we should do it in a way that relieves some of the impact on modest homeowners by giving a property tax swap in the same case. And it's a very straightforward proposition. I challenged Edgar to lead a campaign to rally a few Republicans to vote for it, because he was supporting it at the time. There must be a couple of those of them left, but it doesn't make sense. But Lang's thing, like I said, it perpetuates this idea that most people in Illinois need tax relief. Most people don't. Many do. Many on the lower income. We're down with the other nominally Democratic state of Washington in the bottom 10 of states that are rated as unfair to the lowest quintile of taxpayers. So, in other words, the poor pay disproportionately more. We know that because we know there's a lot of anger out there. But it's being manipulated in a way. And, you know, Lou Lang could say he's passing the 1% tax, right? The tax that will go only on 1% highest income. But that's taking the whole argument about the super rich, who should be taxed more, and there should be even a wealth tax on some of them, obviously. That's not unheard of, actually, in the world. But I don't know. I'm frothing at the mouth here, but do look into the tax swap idea. It's not a radical proposal, and it could be done now without waiting for the constitutional amendment. And I don't know if the deadline is passed or whether it's going to be on the ballot or not. I'm out of the loop on that. But something could be done right now if there was leadership to do this tax swap idea. Like I say, it does get into the budgets of the local property tax recipients, you know, like this. But it could be done with the state portion, and it could be done in a way that levelizes school expenditures too.
Thank you, Paul.
I don't think it's that complicated of an idea. I mean, the details are going to be hard to work out, but the whole idea and the fact that it doesn't get any discussion is just very frustrating to me. So I got to go.
Right, so this is the first time I'm hearing of it, because, you know, we've been asking you know, for ideas. Does anybody have ideas what we can do? And that's why the progressive tax got the traction that it did, because there simply was no other alternatives that were being discussed. So I will definitely make sure I look into this and see what, the, you know, what is it? You know, as a homeowner, I can tell you my property taxes jumped 30%. I almost lost my mind. I'm like, excuse me? If you saw my house, you would understand. I do not live glamorously in any way, shape, or fortune. So for my house to jump 30%, they to tell me, you know, oh, my tax bill is now this high. I'm like, wait a minute. If I tried to sell my house today, I couldn't sell it for the price you have it assessed at. That's absolutely ridiculous.
I hear you. So, but the Eikenberry Commission, you can start with that. It actually did this thing where it was revenue neutral. It just swapped the taxes. But I think in the situation we're in, we ought to at least go back to the revenue level that elapsed when the surtax elapsed. And then, like I say, provide a swap of the taxes so that the people on the lower end of the income range, I don't know how you get down to people that don't have houses, but maybe so.
So, Paul, we appreciate you.
Thank you.
We'll put it on the agenda.
Yeah, thank you so much for that information.
Bye-bye.
Yes. Well, I mean, and I appreciate his calling in, because we really do need to start thinking outside of the box. What can we do to give some type of relief? You know, he's right. We are going to have to raise taxes at some point, but what can we do? What can we do right now? What are some of the smaller fixes that we can make? Which is why I brought up, reeling in some of these tax breaks and other things, because those are immediate fixes that'll bring revenue in. You know, we have to see what can we do and be as proactive as possible to show that we really are being fiscally responsible, that we really are looking after, our constituents' money that they're, providing us to run the state.
Well, I want people to know that you're listening to WEFT 90.1. Ms. Rita Mayfield, representative from Northeast Chicago, is online with me. We are talking about the budget. We talked about the stopgap measure that was done. I got another text, Rita, that says, ask me what role did I play in getting MAP grants and money for the U of I in that bill. I wanted to go back just for a second for the listeners. The initial part, there were two bills. The initial part was to save dire straight schools. That was the initial part of the discussion. But as we began to work, and I spoke to Rita about the need for us to try to include as many as possible so that we could get the support from both sides of the aisle, we wanted to make sure that we funded the MAP grant students at the university. University has the majority of the students enrolled, certainly state is the flagship university. And so we advocated to include the university at a certain percentage in this bill, as well as making sure that the and people look at it like this, because I remember one of our colleagues from Southern Illinois University area in the first bill, he says, I can't vote for that. We can't vote for that because it only funds Southern at 5%. Do you remember that?
I definitely do.
And so some of our Democratic colleagues from the Southern region, as well as our Republican colleagues, on the fence, saying we can't support this because our schools won't get anything out of this funding package. But Rita was open to going and finding as many people as possible, including the university, Southern, to be a part of this package that was ultimately became the stopgap measure to make sure that our universities all receive something in this process. That's how the University of Illinois got into this bill, the ultimate bill that was included there. And then the second part of the question was to speak to the misnomer of the supermajority. I'll kick it to you first, Rita, and then I'll come back to it.
Okay. Well, first, I want to go back to the first part of the text that asked what was your involvement. I just want to make it very clear that Representative Amons had a seat at the table. We're from the very beginning, after the first bill was put out there, that this is what I was intending to do, she came back. She said, we need money for the University of Illinois, and not just the university, but the hospital as well. Make sure that you understand that it's two separate line items, and don't just try to give us just a small amount for just the one. So she was very instrumental in making sure that you got money for both of your line items. And I think that's very important to point out,
because there were other universities that had separate line items, but they didn't. Their representatives didn't speak up. And we got phone calls after the bill was passed saying, why didn't wasn't this included? And I had to be honest, your representative didn't bring it up in the meeting. So I just want to make that very clear. Your representatives really need to know, you know, what's in your budget so that they can help you fight for your line items as well. So having said that, and let me speak to the supermajority. A supermajority means that you have 71 like-minded individuals. We do not have 71 like-minded individuals that are willing to override anything. Yes, we have 71 Democrats. However, if any of you read the newspaper, you will know that one of those individuals has decided that he does not want to be, that he does not want to override anything. Okay? He has basically come out very publicly and said that he doesn't care if we get a budget. He doesn't care about the child care programs. He doesn't care about, you know, education, which is why we're in this mess now, because he absolutely refused to vote for anything that would pass a budget. So until we can get 71 people that are willing to stand up, and they don't all have to be Democrats. We can I get somebody with courage from the Republican side to say, hey, enough is enough. I'm going to vote yes, and we're going to pass a budget. That's all we need is 71 members out of 118. The fact that everybody is saying, well, the Democrats have the supermajority, no, we do not. If we did, we'd have had a budget by now because we have the guts to pass a budget. What we don't have is courage from across the aisle. All we need is one person. Give me two, you know, with enough courage to say, I'm going to stand up for my district. I'm going to stand up for my program, and we're going to do what's right. We don't have that right now.
Interesting. The part of the first part of the question, when we were talking about the University of Illinois Chicago Medical School, the money that was put into the stopgap measure was a match dollar amount so that you could get your federal dollars and not lose them. And so, right. Again, it's important for people to understand that the process of this budget stopgap measure, that process was very complicated, very nuanced, but so many other aspects of federal issues were going to come about if we didn't do some kind of stopgap measure. So we wanted to make sure that the Chicago Medical School could go on and use the needed funds that they need for the federal match, as well as cover some of the MAP grants that we need to do. Students are about to graduate here in the next couple of weeks. And so that was really important to be included. So it wasn't, it certainly wasn't the lack of, I think we might have had in one day, Rita, we had to have had probably four or five caucuses going on, sometimes simultaneously with groups. It was an amazing process to watch all of this happening. Not only did both the Republican and the Democratic caucuses go and caucus together, they went to their own respective caucuses. And then when we came back to the floor, you had legislators circling up and just stop the meeting altogether so we could caucus and hammer out an agreement. On the final point of the bill itself, you called and debated the bill on the floor on short debate before it was ultimately passed, but you decided to, or the amendment anyway, not the bill, the amendment on the first day of the process, which was Wednesday. Was that Wednesday? No, that was Thursday. Thursday evening, which we were there quite long. You of course debated the amendment to an original bill, which the original bill was of course the five universities. So you debated the amendment and you decided to hold it at that time. Why did you make the decision to hold that bill instead of call the vote that Thursday?
It was 9 o'clock at night. And we had one of our representatives that actually had filed notes against the bill, meaning that, you know, a note can stop the bill process for a length of time until you can respond to the answers on that of their particular note. So when we were going through and we were debating whether or not those notes should be held inapplicable, meaning not valid, there was a lot of questions that came up. There were a lot of representatives that were concerned that we didn't have the human services piece in there. There were representatives that didn't quite understand, you know, what process we had used to come to agreement, you know, as far as the funding for the different schools. There were just still a lot of questions. So when we ran that override,
We had 98 yeses, and there were about maybe 15 individuals that just didn't vote because they weren't really sure what it is we were trying to do. So pull the bill out of the record so that we could reach out, because I believe in being inclusive. I believe in open transparency. I want everybody to know exactly what it is that we can do so that they can vote for their district. They need to be able to go back and explain to their district, you know, what happened and how it's going to benefit them or not. So we pulled the bill from the record, met with those individuals, you know, one-on-one. They met with myself. They met with staff. You know, just wanted to give individuals time so that they can make a good decision based on their district. And they did. They made informed decisions because, as you can see, the following day, that bill passed pretty much unanimously. We had two no votes, but everyone else in the chamber voted yes. And I think that really speaks to the process and how inclusive and open and transparent the process was. And I think that's the way all bills should be done.
This bill passed with 106 yeses, two noes in the House, and it passed unanimously in the Senate. So
yes.
it was a interesting, very complicated process, but ultimately people the very next day were clear on the tenets of this bill.
On what they were voting on, yes.
They were clear on that. It was a stopgap measure. It does not make up all 10 months of state university operating expenses,
nope.
Right?
That's right.
It certainly didn't cover all of the map. It did not cover all our community colleges' needs. It was truly a stopgap measure to make sure that our colleges and universities did not have to immediately lay off people, that they didn't ultimately have to close their doors. Those were our main objectives, right?
That's absolutely correct. And we made that very clear on the floor. And as I said, we kept reiterating it when we were having our various caucus meetings, when we were meeting in the back of the chamber, you know, with various individuals. The goal from the very beginning was to provide temporary relief. This is not an FY16 fix. We kept saying it over and over and over again. This is to keep the doors open and the lights on, period. The rest of the money has to come in the form of a FY16, FY17 budget. We have to make sure that that funding is there. We cannot accept the small amount of money that we passed as the budget for FY16. It's an unreasonable expectation.
So you have a crystal ball, I'm sure, right there in front of you this morning.
Of course I do.
And in your crystal ball, you're going to give us a picture of what we should expect next week. I need it. I'm a freshman, so I really need to know what's going to be happening next week.
Well, you know, my crystal ball's coming up a little murky here. But what I would like to see happen is for us to all get back on the same page. That same energy that we had when we left out of there Friday, I'm hoping that the representatives bring back with them on Tuesday. We had individuals that were willing to stand up and do what's right to get something done. We need that same approach with this budget. You know, we can pass an FY16 budget before the end of May. We can pass an FY17 budget before the end of May, but we need to be able to work together. And it's going to take some individuals that are going to have to step out, you know, from the non-political and say, you know what, I'm going to vote for this budget. I'm going to vote to do what's right for my district, for my programs. You know, that is the only way that we're going to get off of ground zero. We need to leave all of the politics behind. I said from the very beginning, if you just let the representatives do it, you know, we can get the job done. And we proved that we can. You know, so I'm hoping that we'll have that opportunity again. You know, I definitely want to be part of the conversation. I'm more than willing, you know, to do everything that I did before and advocate for a really good bill that gives us a budget. Because I think we really need to go back. You know, we don't need another stopgap. We need a budget.
We certainly need a budget. And as you said before, Representative Jack Franks has, I think, 11 or 12. I think it's 11 or 12 corporate loopholes that we can close and immediately, of course, save the state about $2 billion that we can invest in our higher education and human services.
Think of what that can fund. $2 billion, and we didn't have to raise one tax. Think about that.
Our goal is to start at the top, right? So we don't want to put more tax burden on people who are already burdened in this, mm-hmm. in our communities. So the goal certainly would have to be for us to look at the wealthy, right? How much money do we give away as a state? So we want to look at the 12 items that Representative Franks has brought up and said, uh-huh. you know, these should be on the table before we start talking about these other things. But we do need to talk about the ultimate impact of, I think it was about $5 billion, of allowing the income tax to sunset. So that income tax has added a good $5 billion to our deficit that we've not made up anywhere. And so we need to talk about that in long terms. Ultimately, we'll all of these things will be on the table. I'm hoping that the conversation will shift to, okay, let's save some money here first, and then let's look at what long-term revenue structure and strategy we have. And I've not seen that at all.
Right. No, and you're right. We have not had those conversations, but I think we're in a really good position to start having those conversations.
We are indeed in a real good conversation position. I just want to also highlight something that you said earlier. This bill that Representative Rita Mayfield initiated by filing the first five colleges and universities was a discussion among the Black Caucus members. And I know that other caucuses probably had some discussion at some point, but they did not file a bill to do what we're doing, right? And then,
no, that's, you know, there was discussions, you know, and people mm-hmm. can talk all day long, but until you put it in a bill, it doesn't mean anything, you know, and I say that a lot, you know, just to make a point, you have to walk the talk. You know, a lot of times everybody wants to get their name in the newspaper. I don't care about getting my name in the newspaper. I'm going to do what's right, you know, and that meant we needed to file a bill to show that we were serious and not just talking. There was too much talk going on. Everybody, I want to do this. I want to do that. We should do this. We should do that. Okay, well, let's file a bill. Let's start the real conversation, because otherwise it's just talk.
Yes, yes. So we're gonna keep pushing the envelope. You know, our caucus, in this case, the Black Caucus, is 21 members. We have 20 active members at this point, right?
Yes.
So we have 20 active members, which is a large caucus to have. We also have the Downstate Caucus, which I'm a part of the Downstate Caucus as well. And that uh-huh. caucus has about probably 30 something members, right?
That's right.
Yeah. So the collective Downstate Caucus and the Black Caucus was able to come together, push this agenda, and ultimately get our Republican colleagues on board. We hope to continue to work collectively with everyone to bring good decisions to the table. And I do want to say, when we were in caucus with the speaker, Representative Rita Mayfield, because the speaker had a bill himself that was going to go to the floor, as we ended that caucus. And that bill did include human services, but there was no funding stream connected to that bill. And Rita stood up in the caucus and said, no, we're not going to do this. And she was adamant for about five to seven minutes. I mean, if people were there.
That was my passion coming out. Yeah, so.
it was so necessary, Rita, that, you know, because I was feeling the pressure that you were feeling. And it was so necessary that you certainly stood up as our floor caucus chair. For the Black Caucus and said, we are not going to play this game today. We will not leave Springfield and let these schools close. So yes.
Absolutely not. No. Well, we had to stand up for education. You know, myself as a former school board member, education is a priority. And as you mentioned, these schools are not in my district. It's important that we stand up for each other.
And that was the objective. And so, yes, there was some political expediency for us to possibly pick up the Speaker's bill and not run Rita's bill, but it would not have helped the community at all. And so the real fight was going to be, look, we're not going to do this. The Speaker listened to his caucus. And I want people to know that no matter what, you know, people say about the Speaker, at this point, the Speaker is trying to do the best he can to not only save our public universities and our public social service industries, because the governor has every intention, as he said, to kill those things off. And so... Go ahead.
I just want to piggyback off of that because I think that's very important. Individuals need to understand there was two bills. The Speaker had a bill.
Yes.
But he allowed us to run our bill. So people need to really understand, you know, that he is willing to work with us and with the people in the community. He understood the need. You know, he understood how bad off our universities were. And basically, when I got up here and I just started talking and I gave him a really credible argument, he said, okay, we'll run your bill. You know, I think that was very wonderful of him. I thought it was very foresighted as well, because he understood what it is that we were trying to do.
So we have next 30 days coming up that is going to be probably one of the toughest in history, I think. I've read history books on Illinois government, and what we're experiencing today, I don't think I've ever experienced before. So as far as reading it in the book, there was no reference point that I could point to describe how my first 2 years was going to go. It has been nothing like the books. So
The book is, it was funny though, right? You're reading through, it's like, didn't happen. Right.
That's right. So history is a good indicator of what could happen, but certainly don't always give you the full story. So we are making history right now in Illinois for the first time, where we are openly discussing the decimation of our public institutions, and trying
Absolutely.
To protect them has been a very difficult challenge, but we're up to it and we'll continue to work on it. So I want to thank you, Representative Mayfield, for spending the hour with me, giving me some of your time this early Saturday morning. I know you're busy.
Oh, anytime at all.
Well, we will, I'm going to take a break and throw a special shout out song to our governor from Michael Jackson called Smooth Criminal. And I will let you go, Miss Rita Mayfield.
How about some Purple Rain?
We'll come back to Purple Rain in a minute. We love Purple Rain.
Okay.
This one is a shout out to Governor Ronald, and it's by Michael Jackson called Smooth Criminal.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much. Take care.
All right. God bless.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, I didn't want that one. I wanted Smooth Criminal, so they decided to play what they wanted to play instead of playing Smooth Criminal for me. Hello? So I think we are going to play Smooth Criminal right now. Let's try this again. That was a small donation selection for our governor from Michael Jackson, Smooth Criminal. We have certainly enjoyed our first hour. I want you to know that the views and opinions expressed here are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associates, station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated. These are the views of Sister Carol, who's flying solo in the studio this morning. Brother A-Dub had committed himself to an obligation all day, so it left me here all alone. I want you to know that there are benefits to be a WFT airshifter, though, because I'm one, and I've been one for over a decade. And it's been a pleasure to listen, talk, and share with you for probably, let me see, it's been about maybe 12 years now since we've been doing this. But that has been the best 12 years of my experience. But one of those benefits of being an air shifter, being a member of WEFT, is you can take the air shifters training class for free. You can take the same class that we took that got us ultimately on the air, that got us ultimately on this Saturday morning radio show called Higher Ground. A new session is coming up, though, so you can take this opportunity to join WEFT as a member and just take the training. You never know when you have an idea for a radio show that you want to do or information that you want to share. I believe the next training comes up on May 3rd and 4th. And in addition, you'll have two studio sessions scheduled at that time. So you don't just take the book work. You'll come in studio and learn how to use the board, the phones. Someone's calling me on the station line. You can't get me. So if you're listening to WEFT and you're calling the station, you need to call me. And the first line is free at 217-359-5483. You have to fly live with me at 217-359-5483. That line is open and you're welcome to call it. You could also call me on 217-359-6545. That's 217-359-6545. You're welcome to call me there as well, because I am paying attention and I can answer both lines, multitask, play Prince, send a shout out to the governor, Smooth Criminal for Michael Jackson. We could talk about the budget and everything else. But in the last hour, I do want to talk briefly about the essence of what's happening in our community, the level of violence that has struck another beautiful young lady, Ashley, who unfortunately lost her life about a week or so ago, and her family is really broken up by this terrible tragedy. So I want to talk a little bit about the violence that we and how we need to stop it. Go ahead, caller. You're on the air.
Hey, Carol. This is Sandra Auten.
Oh, good morning, Sandra.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. I'm good. Thank you.
I figured you would get around to these announcements, but I thought I would just share some stuff going on in the community that your listeners probably want to know about.
Absolutely.
You know about the progressive potluck this afternoon?
I think I do. and that'll be at 4 o'clock at the Independent Media Center today. We'll talk about that. Let me just say, I saw several things. I get all these notices, but the progressive potluck today, it is a potluck, so you can bring something to share with others.
I'm bringing a beautiful kale salad with kale out of my garden.
And that sounds, I'm going to bring a salad too, so we'll be matching today. Our goal is to get people in a conversation about politics and how it's going to work on the local level, and getting people engaged and trained to run for office. That is what we're doing. That is what we intend to do, and we intend to build an agenda to lead us to a more progressive community. And so that'll be today at 4.
And to let people know, though, that they don't have to come being fearful that they will be roped into anything, that there's lots of room in the conversation for any kind of activism or just progressive networking, and just to know what your neighbors are doing. And one
hold
of
on
my
second
main
caller.
Go ahead.
Second caller, hold on for a second, please.
And I just wanted to say that one of my main agendas there is to help get a progressive calendar going so that we know what each other are doing, so that we can plan our events and that we can always know what's on the agenda coming up,
excellent.
Ways to communicate with each other. So I'll be running a workshop about communication.
Excellent.
Or the
excellent.
Breakout session about communication. And, you know, I've been part of the Octopus when we used to communicate through alternative newspaper, been part of WEFT and the
yes.
IMC, and I just think communication is so important. So I'm going to really be advocating for helping people to find easy ways to communicate with each other.
Excellent. So I look forward to it.
Yeah. And there's a concert afterwards. You see the announcement for that there on the board about the Dave Lippmann concert tonight at the IMC.
Let's see, Dave Lippmann concert on the board tonight. I shall find the announcement here in a minute.
Okay, so Dave Lippmann is a singer-songwriter who's a satirical, political lyricist, and I think he's going to be at the IMC tonight.
Oh, I see it, yes.
At 7 o'clock, sponsored by WEFT and the Public Eye.
So, it says it starts at 7:30.
Okay,
today,
7:30,
so,
good.
But people can come at 7 so you can network and talk to each other, be on time.
Yeah.
How about that?
Yeah, so it'll be kind of a lead off from the Progressive Potluck. And
yes.
One more thing, that we are producing the CU Progressive News every Monday from 6 to 7 p.m. You can tune in for the West Extended Courier from 6 to 7 p.m. on Monday. We've been producing it with the conjunction with the Public Eye and WEFT. And just one more thing, there is a house concert benefiting WEFT this coming Thursday, May 4th. Is that right? Thursday, May 4th. Go to the weft.org webpage, and Kevin Elliott, my husband, is one of the singer-songwriters, Rupert Waits from New York, and is being hosted at my house. And so everybody's welcome to that. It's a benefit for WEFT. So
cool.
I'll go
to WEFT's page and make those announcements again if it's not listed there. I see the one at top. I'll do that before we close the hour. Thank you so much, Miss Sandra.
All Otten. Right.
All right.
Take
see
care.
You soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Second caller. I got you.
Hey, this is Adiemi.
Oh, hey. How are you?
Pretty good. I'm doing well.
Wonderful.
How are you?
I'm great this morning. I am really great.
Just wanted to bring up a quick topic. Didn't know if you brought this up yet. But,
please, go for it.
It's going around campus right now. Thursday or Friday morning, there were racial vandalism on campus in Armory, Greg Hall.
Oh, Lincoln really?
Hall. And, yeah, there were swastikas placed in those three dorm halls.
I was not aware of that.
Yes, it happened Thursday morning between the hours of 7 and 8 a.m. Those three lecture halls were vandalized. There were swastikas placed in them, and they tell us that the police are looking at the surveillance videos, but I believe it should be pretty clear on who did the incident, because it was happened in three lecture halls in the span of 1 hour, and you should see who's coming in and out of those buildings at those times.
I think there are absolutely cameras everywhere on campus,
yeah.
So I would imagine that they're going to identify the folks and get with them soon. So, wow, I didn't know about that, actually, Yemi. I appreciate you calling and sharing that. I did receive, there's obviously a heightened racial tension that seems to be growing again. You know, each semester there seems to be something, some other intolerance effort on the parts of people who don't understand history enough to know that you cannot, you know, you can't hate your way to solvency or, you know, whatever they're trying to do with this kind of hateful rhetoric and chalking things on the quad and now vandalizing these three lecture halls. And I heard about a noose being thrown at a African-American, I think, a worker about a week or so ago. I got a picture of that sent to me. So just this heightened racial climate on campus is quite unfortunate. I think a lot of it has to do with the political conversation that's going on right now in America as a whole. And people are starting to say, yeah, that's right. We need to control everything and, you know, and push, you know, these crazy radical ideas against other minority communities or even LGBT communities and things like that. So I hope the university takes seriously this this developing threat. I believe it's a very dangerous threat.
Yeah. Do you believe it'll get better by November?
I don't have a crystal ball to say that it will. You know, I think, again, the only way that to really, the university can address this through its legal means, which it should protect all the students. If there are actual videotape of this, then, it is, the responsibility of the police department to bring those people to justice who committed these acts. And say that we just won't tolerate that behavior on a campus. And that's what needs to be done. So we'll see what happens. But in the political framework of the country, that stuff is not getting better. The conversations I hear, I had to stop listening to the news recently on the presidential side because it was getting crazier every single day, you know. So I've kind of backed off of that a little bit because it really does mess with your heart and mind. And so I tried to leave that a piece alone.
That's true.
Yeah. So I don't think it's going to get all that much better between now and November unless we get rid of the people who are promoting this nonsense, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. I agree with you.
So I am going to share an article that I got from one of our preeminent scholars here, Professor Lou Turner. Because we have so much violence going on in the community, I attended the candlelight vigil yesterday for Ashley, who was killed and ultimately dismembered and thrown into Clinton Lake.
Wow.
Devastating situation, which we don't have all of the information yet on the perpetrators of this terrible crime. But we do have the family who's left to pick up the pieces and whose mother is so devastated by this incident that I attended the candlelight vigil yesterday and spoke to the family and to the community on this issue. And I said to our scholar, I said, hey, this case really, I think, goes to the heart of why we have to deal with the not only mental illness in the community, but the issue of drug addiction, drug selling. We need to deal with those issues. So I want to share this, and I'm going to hang up from you, Yiming, so I can share the article from Professor Turner as he encapsulates the case of Ashley Gibson. Okay.
Thanks, Carol.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye. Thank you to those who've called in this morning and helped me along the way. I do want to close the show by really highlighting this terrible tragedy that's taken place. And I'm going to do my best to read it verbatim from Professor Turner, who was attempting to get here with me, but the marathon has made it difficult for people to travel. So he may still be on his way. You know, we will see what happened. In the case of Ashley, we don't know, as I said, completely what all the details are, what happened to her. We do know that ultimately she died in some incident. I don't know how she died, but the people who were with her decided that they were going to try to cover this up and ultimately made a terrible decision. So let me just say this is entitled Black on Black Gender Violence, The Case of Ashley Gibson by Professor Lou Turner. Understanding Black on Black violence is difficult, especially in the case of perverse crimes of violence that the Black community perceive as going beyond the pale of what is understood as the norm. The case of Ashley Gibson, whose dismembered body was found this week in Clinton Lake, is such a case of perverse violence. Of course, the tendency is to isolate such horrific events and perceive them through the tragic lens of individual behavior and vulnerability. However, the black-on-black character of the offense in the aftermath of the arrest of six young black men reveals that the event is being viewed in anything but individualistic terms by society and by the black community itself. The media will move effortlessly between the individual significance. I got a caller here. Go ahead, caller. You're on the air.
Well, yeah, thank you very much. I was listening to your show, Carol. I think you're doing a good job.
I really appreciate you. I hope you're still listening because I'm sharing an article from Professor Lou Turner on the recent death of Ashley.
Well, yeah. I was listening to that, and it sounded like you said this girl was murdered. Do you know if that's true or not?
Well, I don't know how she died. I think I came back and said I don't know exactly how she died, but I do know that her dismembered body was found in Clinton Lake. The folks who have been targeted and arrested, possibly perpetrators of this crime, we will find out soon how she actually died.
Well, okay. Thank you for clearing that up. I was just wondering. It's a pretty sad situation. I think you're doing a good job in Springfield, and I'm going to keep on supporting you.
Thank you very much for calling.
Okay, now.
Bye-bye. As we said, the media will move effortlessly between the individual significance of the tragic case of Ashley Gibson and the racialized social subtext of black-on-black violence. After all, early this year, a white news anchor in Pittsburgh was fired for making racist remarks stereotyping black males in the aftermath of a horrific murder spree in the black community on her Facebook page. And you can go and find that on Facebook. It says Wendy Bell Pittsburgh, so you can look her up. However, the perverse circumstances of the crime involving dismemberment and disposing of Ashley's body in Clinton Lake has elicited an altogether new response from the black community, one of gruesome revulsion and consternation that something new and disturbing is going on in the psyche of black youth that represents an evolution on black crime. As outside the norm as Ashley Gibson's homicide may appear, unpacking its social context is the only thing that will help orient the black community and help us make sense of the grisly circumstances surrounding her death. Criminologists are of two minds on the question of gender homicide. Male attacks on females express males' pathological fears of females attaining social equality with them, or psychological superiority over them, or violence against women is linked to the socioeconomic inequalities that are pervasive throughout the United States society. In either case, how is socioeconomic, racial, and gender inequality linked to female homicide? Is female homicide another social cause of this country's socioeconomic inequality? When we examine these questions, we find that the very circumstances of Ashley Gibson's life and background, her engaging personality and positive outlook, her achievements and future prospects, play into the pathological misogynistic inequality. Relative to black males in her social cohort, Ashley Gibson's educational, occupational, and income achievements, ironically and tragically, would make her a target of male violence. Our assumption, false as it may turn out, is that Ashley Gibson's higher level of educational, occupational, and income attainment would afford her protection against lethal assault. The reality is, in fact, the reverse. To be sure, violence against lower income women result in high levels of victimization. But what contributes to the shock and trauma of the black community in reaction to the horrible circumstances of the death of Ashley Gibson is that her socioeconomic status and accomplishments did not afford her protection against violent victimization. In short, poverty breeds contempt for women. Researchers have found that relative and racial inequalities are significant predictors of violence against women. This means that relative inequality between black men and women, where the socioeconomic status of women supersedes that of men, is a predictor of violence against women, and that racial inequality that alienates black men is predictive of violence against black women. Combined, as they are in the black community, relative and racial inequalities form a, quote, perfect storm of gender violence against black women in every socioeconomic level. Thus, violence against black women represent an unspoken, quote, cost of racialized social inequality. The relative social inequality between black women and men means that black women's participation in the workforce makes them more vulnerable to the threat of homicide because of the time they spend in the unsafe setting of the streets, is going back and forth to work or spending time among strangers. Employment therefore raises the risk level of violence against black women. The socio-demographic factors that contribute to black female risk of violence are, quote, unmarried status, female workforce participation, occupational segregation of females in so-called women's work, and higher rates of female college enrollment. These are all five areas that have been contributed to socioeconomic status. I'm going to take a quick plug-in break there. Give me 1 second, and I'll come back with Professor Lou Turner so that we can kind of talk about this in a more specific area as he's describing it here in his commentary. It is important for us to understand firsthand what we are dealing with, and it is an important part of the female psyche. So give me 1 second, and I will make sure that we can get Dr. Turner on air with us. I'll give you a people song from Stevie Wonder and Barbara Streisand. She was one of the artists that I really liked early on in my little life. I liked Barbara Streisand, unlike other people. And so let me see what I can do here. Oh, it's not Barbara Streisand. Let's see if we can find the song so that I can play it. Let's see if that worked out. Give me 1 second. Michael Jackson. I'm back. I really wanted Barbara Streisand, but I couldn't find her. So I had to greet my wonderful guest that's joined me this morning. So we're going to proceed as we talked about before. I was just sharing with the listeners the paper that you wrote on black-on-black violence and the case of Ashley Gibson. And if you want to take a headphone and mic, you are live. We have a live studio. Go ahead and say good morning.
Good morning.
Let's say it again.
Good morning.
Okay, I cannot hear you.
Good morning.
Uh-huh. Let's see why I can't hear you, because I should be able to. That is off. All right, so let me turn up your sound here, because I can't hear you. Okay, say it again.
Good morning.
Now I got you.
Good.
All right. So, Professor Lou Turner, I did already introduce you to Professor Turner before he joined me. It's a little tough to get around Champaign-Urbana right now, right?
Yeah, it is.
The marathon is going on. I certainly applaud all those who are out there running this morning in this cold, windy.
Yeah.
Not windy, but rainy.
Rainy.
Cold. And I don't mind rain as long as it's warm. But cold rain is another whole discussion. But I started off reading the intro of your piece on black-on-black gender violence. And I was moved by how you identify some of the factors that you described as the factors that lead to higher incidence of violence against women. And I was actually shocked by the factors that you are citing here. Mm-hmm. The work that the woman does outside of the home, so going to work. Let me see if I can go back and find the exact point that I was just reading at. Because it really struck me and said, I never even thought about that. So let's see, you said unmarried status, female workforce participation, occupational segregation of female so-called women's work, and higher rates of female college enrollment are all indicators of the risk of violence against black women. Right. Can you explain that more for me? Because I would have never made this list, right? Yeah, this would not have been a list that I would have come up with.
There's a couple of ways to, to come at this. One is, let me explain, it's probably easy to talk about a little of a narrative. When I first began working on the south, far south side of Chicago for a community organization by the name of Developing Communities Project, it was Barack Obama's old community organization when he was a community organizer, there were two phenomena that were hitting that far south side community. The communities were roughly Roseland, Pullman, West Pullman, and Riverdale. Riverdale is one of the poorest community areas in Chicago. It's where all Elk Gardens public housing is. And there were two phenomena that I remember. One that existed before I started working there, just about a few months, and then the other one a few months after I started working. The first phenomenon was that they were discovering all of the these women's bodies in abandoned homes. Abandoned buildings or structures, in which there are a lot of them on the far south side of Chicago, abandoned buildings.
Okay.
The area had one of the far, the highest foreclosure rates in the nation, and so had the highest abandonment rate in the city. They were finding the bodies of women, and it made national news. The second phenomenon that...
Can you speak closer into the mic?
Yeah, the second phenomenon that I came across occurred after I started working there. And that is that women were getting off of the bus after coming home from work or going to school and being attacked. And it was just this odd phenomenon that, that was kind of riveted, the city's attention. I mean, it wasn't just community. It was a rash of these things. And it kind of woke me up to this, to the issues surrounding violence against women. The organization that I work for did work with young women and girls, and I helped them organize, I think the only, Take Back the Night March through that community. I say only because I don't think there have been many in black communities. Take Back the Night is a phenomenon of the early women's liberation movement from the 1970s and 80s, actually 1980s. And so it was the idea of women asserting their right to be out, because, and these factors that you list are one
thing. Okay.
Okay. That's one way of looking at this thing. The other way is the kind of social scientific-y way that I came at it. And this comes from researchers who have looked at two issues relating to female homicides. And they're kind of counterintuitive. One is a feminist explanation, and the data challenges the feminist explanation. The other one is a traditional, quote-unquote, explanation that is traditional.
That's what I took. From your list. It took me to the traditional thought.
Right.
Right?
Okay. But this is it. The feminist explanation argues that getting an education, employment, income, those are things that should afford women protection against violence. That's the feminist point of view.
So, and good education,
occupation, and income.
Income. Okay.
And the research was showing that, quite frankly, that was actually the opposite was the case.
Hmm.
That it was actually making those elements were as correlated. I don't want to say cause and make, but those elements are also correlated with higher rates of violence against women. The traditionalist view was, this is even crazier, that marriage afforded women against protection. Yeah, afforded women protection against violence. And again, the data showed it's the very opposite. There were more women who were being
abused by their,
Right. And so, on the contrary, women who were separated and divorced had lower rates of violence and whatnot. So they left, and assuming then that they had the means, education, income, and whatnot to leave the marriage. And so there are a number of cross-cutting factors that we see. And the thing that I try to bring out is how the racialized social inequality within the Black community is a factor in all of this. And it's something that we just have not been looking at, because we've been looking at social inequality, racial inequality, structural racism in so many other areas, but we're not looking at the consequences that this may be having from the point of view of gender and women.
So you have a sentence here that as I was reading the socio-demographic factors that you listed, I go further down and it says their status in a patriarchal society raises the threat level against them, making them potential victims of violence and homicide. And this is a statement that I raised a question with Aaron the other day, saying, you know, how do we get rid of this patriarchy that actually subjugates women and make them second-class citizens, as we were fighting back in the women's liberation movement, thus in some way justifying the mistreatment and killing of women. And the response in the society is, and some of the negative things we've heard, you know, just rumors that's been circulating around this young lady's death, kind of feeds into that patriarchy.
That's right. That's right.
How do we really address that part of this?
The one thing I tried to indicate, and it needs to be unpacked because I did this pretty fast, was that we have to look at the contradiction between roles and status. The roles that women play, Black women play in a society in which there is so much income inequality, in which men are actually have less income, more unemployed, less enrollment in colleges than women and whatnot. So their status is different. But their roles in a patriarchal society puts them lower. That is, puts women lower. So there's this contradiction between their status and their roles of society. And you have, you know, Black social psychologist Phil Bowman talks about role strain. And a lot of his analysis was certainly of Black men. That is, you have a role to play, the role of the father. There's a strain on you playing that role if you're unemployed. There's a strain on that, so it's called role strain. There's a strain on that role if you're in prison. It's a strain on that role, whatever. And so when you put the dynamics of men and women together, the consequence of women may be being employed, being enrolled in school versus a male who is not, puts kind of these interpersonal strains on the role of the quote-unquote male or man and whatnot. So there's this role strain, as Phil Bowman talks about. My wife, Ruby Mendenhall's, kind of transferred that model to her work on Black women in Inglewood in Chicago, and looking at role strain on them. So there's a strain on the role of being whoever it is that is. And we have multiple roles, of course, that we play.
So the interesting, I want the listeners to know that you're listening to WEFT 90.1 FM. I'm speaking with Professor Lou Turner. We certainly send our condolences out to Miss Ashley Gibson's family, her mother and her aunt and grandmother. They're all in town, unfortunate situation. So we want to send our love to them. But we also want to really talk in terms of, you know, how this is starting to be developed or how it's growing in our community around the issue of violence against Black women in the community. Certainly, you're welcome to call and ask a question to Professor Turner, 217-359-5483. I will take your call still as we get ready to wrap up today's show. We'll talk about this more in the coming months, of course. So you talked about role strain, which I hadn't heard the term, but I know what it is, right? Mm-hmm. So most of us as Black women, we know what that is, right? We've heard the higher level of domestic violence in a household is usually in relationship to black women working, black male not working, you ain't got no money, so you don't like what I'm saying, you can step, you know. So that happens on a regular basis, the conflict between the two. The aspect of Ashley's death, which is still unclear, but the aspect of her death in relationship to these her black male counterparts, right? You describing some somewhat of a kind of male backlash. What is that?
Well, it's in any patriarchal society, and in this case, we're looking at a patriarchal society within a patriarchal society. We're talking about the black community.
Correct.
And so where you have disparities, my argument is a structural one, that I know that, and necessarily so, we have to talk about the individual circumstances of this young woman's demise, and that's important. That's no, I don't want to belittle it. But it's also an opportunity to look at the structural questions, the context in which this happens. And I mentioned how the media plays this. On the one hand, they want to tell the story of the circumstances at an individualistic level, but at the same time, they'll slip and slide into a subtext about black-on-black violence, which is structural, but very racialized and whatnot. I mentioned this white news anchor in Pittsburgh who was fired for her Facebook page about a similar situation. Black family was having a cookout. Two guys showed up and killed, most of the family and whatnot. And she went on and on about how it is. And so it was both individual, because she said, oh, to show you the opposite, I was at this restaurant, this young African-American was working so hard and whatnot. So not all people are like these guys. And she had these stereotypes about these men. Nobody had even been identified. Yeah, but she went off on this. So the media plays a very important and often negative role in creating these images and playing this individual versus the structural kinds of analysis. But I think it's important to see that the social inequality, the racialized social inequality in the black community has incredible consequences for black women specifically. And we have not been looking at it enough. I mean, as much as I don't think it is the case, and at least I hadn't seen it, and other people will certainly argue with me, certainly from Black Lives Matter, that the black community did call her name in terms of black women who were...
Right, yes.
That's a whole... But I'm saying that there is this much larger issue that we're not looking at in terms of what is happening with black women in the community. This happened at the time of the HIV/AIDS epidemic. It was the highest levels of HIV/AIDS in this country is among black women and whatnot. But the stigma of it being a gay disease or intravenous drug just totally shut down our religious institutions in terms of dealing with this and whatnot. And black women have been the greatest victims of it. And so there's this large area of the our reality as black people having to do with black women that we are just not dealing with sufficiently. And this, this is a sad case of this young black woman, is my point, kind of brings this to the fore, and we shouldn't lose the opportunity to deal with some of these issues.
I think that's a very good point to bring up about the social framework for which this heinous crime, whatever it turns out to be, how it was developed, how it comes out, right? The structural implications of this crime. And I'm recalling the period of when I was young, the welfare reform kind of, go back to work, you can't get welfare anymore, even though there were very few jobs even then for women to do that weren't, educated in the college level, like my mother was just a worker. And, my father couldn't be in that house in order for her to get a support.
Right.
So she did work, but she didn't have enough because the cost of living is more than what you're earning in the marketplace. And so she did work, but in order to have assistance, you had to play this whole Russian roulette game. I remember that game as a little girl. you know, mm-hmm. this person can't be here, right, during yeah. these home visits and all of this right. structural stuff that was created at that time. And so now we see this kind of playing out again mm-hmm. in this era where you have large unemployment among African-American males, largely, mm-hmm. Certainly African-American males between 16 and 25 right. are unbelievably unemployed numbers, some 50-60% unemployment. And so you have this underground market going on, and you have all these other things that develop out of poverty. Right. But we aren't addressing the poverty issues that create the violence. Can right. can we talk a little bit about
well,
that?
Well, we should not think that, economic and social issues, structural issues, have psychological consequences. Mm. And black men are as male chauvinist as white men. And so there is a backlash on the part of black men toward black women. But it's created by the social inequality that exists, that a society has no use for their labor. And even it's what's called relative inequality, relative to someone else, you mm-hmm. are better or worse off than someone you perceive as, in this case, being better off. But poverty is the hidden America that we're not talking about. Some of my wife's research about the hidden America, the other America now is the hidden America. And it's totally out of sight for most Americans. And not enough time and not enough emphasis is being placed on looking at this, this hidden America. And so it bubbles up and manifests itself. It hits us as trauma, frankly, a kind of secondary trauma when we see events like this happen, because suddenly it pops up, but it's always been there. And we shouldn't be surprised about it.
And even by the amount of domestic violence in the black community, that is actually a hidden violence that's not talked about very much.
Right.
But we know it's happening, and it is within the context of your initial framework that you've written here today. It's within that context of structural inequality between the male and female that majority of the fights are taking place in the black community.
Right.
These are around issues of money and, you know, mm-hmm. not having enough for this, or lifestyle issues that are directly contributing to the amount of violence that's taking place. But I want to kind of read directly from your paper.
Could I just mention one thing?
Sure.
I think we
mm-hmm.
need to have a little bit more on the, a little bit on the other side. And that is, people have also shown, researchers, so Charles Blow wrote a beautiful column a few months ago on this, and I think Cindy Adichie-Jewa picked this up in one of the columns he wrote for the News Gazette, that as it turns out, black men, particularly young black men, are much more involved in rearing kids than any other group in America.
Mm.
And so rather than the kind of thing that either the president or Bill Cosby put on black men not share, pulling up their responsibilities, it actually, the data actually show that black men in many cases are much more involved in the rearing and the household rearing of children. So we need to be aware of that as well. That's one of the odd kind of consequences of this social inequality as well, that we don't want to end up kind of pathologizing or demonizing black men, when in fact we actually see evidence that in many cases young black men are stepping up and being responsible. But yeah, we have this other thing about
the other America.
Yeah, violence.
The black revolutionary psychiatrist Frantz Fanon revealed another dimension of black-on-black violence in his 1961 work, The Wretched of the Earth. Fanon delineated the various ways in which black behavior is pathologized by psychologists, public officials, the police, and the media when they encounter the various behavioral responses of black people to social inequality. Give us a, you know, synopsis of this work. You know, Frantz Fanon does this work in 61, identifying critical issues that will create this level of violence in the black community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he talks about he theorized what we now call self-hatred. In fact, he calls it that. He was one of the first people as a psychiatrist to analyze this. But he again puts it in the structural context. In his case, it was colonialism, but we used it in the 60s as a framework for here. The quote of him by him is very, very interesting in that he makes the case that we act as screens for each other in preventing us from seeing who the real enemy is. So he says, when a neighbor goes after his neighbor, it means that he's not seeing who the real enemy, the structural issues of racism that we're talking about. And so he uses this metaphor of screens that prevent us from seeing the real thing, because a colonial context or occupied context or a context of what we all identify as the Black community as an occupied, entity, is one in which if you cage people, essentially, they will turn on each other. And he's talking about people turning on each other and the psychology of their turning on each other rather than turning and seeing who the real enemy is. This, by the way, is the dynamics of domestic violence. This has been long that you come home and take out on your family what you dealt with at the workplace. Of course, you're afraid to take it out there.
So let me read these direct points here on how you interpret what Frantz Fanon puts in this 1961 book, The Wretched of the Earth. Number one, Black behavior is pathologized as criminogenic and deserving of authoritarian repression. Yep. Number two, Black pathologized behavior is viewed as, quote, an unconscious frustration complex whose recurrence could be treated by radical psychological appropriate methods. We'll come back to that. Three, Black pathologized behavior is framed as a neurobiological reductionism, eugenics, that, and then number four, necessitates its negation in theory and in practice. So as we look at the unfortunate demise of our young sister, Ashley, and the others that have gone before her and those who may come after her, as this turning in on each other and the frustrations of the larger society playing itself out. And so I don't know any of these people who were involved in this. I don't know any of them. But I can imagine that obviously there is a disconnect between life that in this case Ashley represents, and their own lives that ultimately will be sacrificed to this pathology.
Yeah, Fanon goes so far, and it's quite, and it wasn't controversial so much at the time, but this very phenomena has resurfaced. I've heard analysis of Black-on-Black violence in these same terms. He views Black-on-Black violence as a form of suicide. And this has come up again recently in trying to make sense or trying to understand Black-on-Black violence in Chicago, for instance. And so the consequences of that means that we've lost some sense of our humanity. And if you've lost the sense of your own humanity, then right, it's nothing. You can't really see somebody else's humanity. So
we have a long way to go with few minutes to do it. I do want to give you the last, few seconds to surmise how important it is for us to identify this within the structural framework as opposed to just an individual incident for the Black community to be able to resolve these issues and move forward. How do you see that?
Well, Carol, it's a difficult subject, and we need much more work being done One thing we have not discussed, and it certainly is a major factor in a lot of this, and that is drug use in the Black community. And we're going to need a lot in the area of policy and changing of policy to deal with this. We've had this warehousing and incarceration in terms of drug. There seems to be some turning away and turning toward more treatment. But we also are way behind in terms of mental health resources across this country, but certainly in the Black community. I mean, if you think of the consequences of this structural inequality and the Black community being the epicenter of that in this country, and you think of the psychological and the social psychological consequences of that, I mean, there are no psychological